is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. No doubt you've noticed the presidential campaign is heating up, and Ohio is feeling the heat. The RNC was in town to talk about efforts to train poll watchers. We'll hear about that. We'll also discuss an Inquirer investigation into deaths and injuries caused by Metro buses, and we'll look back at Cincinnati Beatlemania in 1964. Got a lot to get into for our weekly news review today. Here to get us started are, from the Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau, reporter and producer Joe Ingles and correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks.
Hey, Lucy.
So great to have you. Sarah, as I mentioned, the Republican National Committee chairman was in Columbus late last week talking about volunteers. Tell us more about that. Like, it seems like a national effort to get folks trained for elections.
Absolutely. It is. It's the RNC, the national RNC, is looking to train poll watchers. So these are volunteers. Poll watchers are not a new concept. They're volunteers that go to polling places on election day, and they kind of observe the process. Oftentimes they are partisan. They may be working with one party or another, but they're looking for bigger transparency in the voting process. So they're not poll workers. They're not working the polls, but they're kind of watching the process. And the RNC started their tour in Ohio. So Attorney General Dave Yost was at this event on Friday. And, you know, while the Brennan Center for Justice says there are benefits to having poll watchers, there have also been issues in recent years of intimidation of the actual election workers who are there. So I think there are some concerns on the other side about that.
Did the RNC folks, did they express any concerns about that you're aware of?
They, to my understanding, they didn't. I think that their training is serving to kind of show people how to be proper poll watchers. And I know my colleague Karen Kassler, who was there reporting on the story, you know, she asked folks who were at this event about concerns of intimidation. And one person said, you know, he thought that what they focused on in the training sessions was to respect poll workers and respect voters and the entire process.
Joe, you talked to Secretary of State Frank LaRose about this, right? What did he tell you?
Yeah, I talked to Secretary of State LaRose, and he said, yeah, you know, if they want to come in and be poll watchers, that's great, because Ohio law allows for that. But he said, what's really better is that the state is always needing poll workers. And he said if they would come in and if Ohioans would go to the polls and actually volunteer to work for the day at the polls, they get paid. So I said volunteer, but they do get paid. Poll workers get paid. But if they would work for the day, that they would actually be part of the process, and they would have a better insight into what's going on and have more access to what's going on if they were actually working it. So he was really encouraging that.
And Ohio has bipartisan election workers in every county, right, Joe? Isn't that kind of part of the system in Ohio?
Yes, that is part of the system in Ohio. They have to have so many Republicans, so many Democrats to make it even, to make it, you know, nonpartisan. We've always got observers from various groups, even nonpartisan voting groups come in and observe the process. Election kind of protection folks are always out there. So it's not a new thing to have poll watchers. By any means.
Okay. Well, speaking of Secretary of State Frank LaRose, he announced this week that his office had found people who are not citizens who had registered to vote or had voted either last year or earlier this year. How many people are we talking about?
Well, in the scheme of things, a very, very small number of people. You've got to remember that in Ohio, we have 8 million voters. He's talking about a very small number of people being involved with this. It's basically people who were registered to vote. Almost about 600,000 were registered to vote who shouldn't have been on the polling, been on the voter rolls.
I'm going to interrupt you there, Joe. Did you say 600,000? I thought it was almost 600.
600. I'm okay. Sorry. 600. Okay. Yes, okay. Six, not 600,000.
Okay.
600.
Okay. Great.
So thanks for catching that.
Sure thing.
But there were, there's a big difference.
Yeah.
But there were almost 600 who were not citizens who were on the rolls as registered voters. Now, of those, about 138 had actually cast ballots in the last couple of years. But, you know, Lucy, I talked to an attorney here in Columbus who represents people who get in this situation. He represents a lot of immigrants. And he was saying that, and even Secretary LaRose said this too, that a lot of people who get on these lists of being non-citizens, but yet having registered to vote, they get on there because they go for another thing, like a driver's license, for example, where they're required to offer, would you like to register to vote? Now, they shouldn't be offering that to a non-citizen, but, you know, humans are humans. They make mistakes. Like, you know, that's normal. And so they make a mistake, they offer it, they somehow, someone who's not a citizen gets put on this list. And so Secretary LaRose says that he had sent out mailings saying, you are on this list. If you are not registered, you should not be registered, please take yourself off. And that these numbers are coming out of the people who did not take themselves off the list and people who actually voted illegally.
Is there any evidence this is, you know, more widespread or that these votes change the outcome of any races?
It doesn't look like any of them changed any outcome of any races, and it doesn't look like it's widespread, but they've turned it over to the county prosecutors who will take a closer look at this. You know, this is all coming from, at this point, from LaRose's office and his people basically checking databases. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the county prosecutors can take a look at it and they can determine whether to actually file charges against any of these folks. Okay. But again, I want to stress, this is a very small number when you look at the total number of voters. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like from the people you talk to, this, they think this is usually some kind of mistake or understanding that it's not happening with fraudulent intent in most of these cases, or maybe in any of them.
Yes, the attorney that I talked to said it's almost always a mistake.
Okay. Well, let's talk now about the lawsuit over the language approved by the Ohio Ballot Board for Issue 1. This is probably going to feel a little bit like Groundhog's Day for you, Joe, because we talked to you about the ballot board last week. Remind us again briefly what Issue 1 would do.
Okay, Issue 1 would scrap the current process for redistricting. It would replace it with a citizen panel that would decide redistricting based on some data, some metrics. And that panel could not include any politicians or lobbyists. Basically, the idea is to take the politicians and the lobbyists out of it, because the current method of redistricting, supporters of this amendment say, the current method of redistricting has been a problem because the majority Republicans have not adhered to the principles of it. Now, the Republicans would say, yeah, we did everything we were supposed to by law. Mm-hmm. But so that's, you know, you're setting up a fight between Republicans and Democrats. But you should note that in this citizens, not politicians group, there are many Republicans, including former Ohio Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Maureen O'Connor, who is a Republican and helped write the amendment. Mm-hmm.
And this citizens, not politicians group, this group that is pushing for this amendment and that's suing the Ohio Ballot Board now, is arguing that the language the ballot board adopted is unconstitutional. Briefly explain why they say that.
Okay, so what they're talking about is the summary language. This is what you see when you go to cast a ballot, that language at the top, that's called the summary language. It's not the same as the actual amendment. But in this case, Citizens Not Politicians is saying it's not the same. It's not even a summary of the amendment. And the language was changed to have a different tone and to say different things. In fact, it says that this new process would allow gerrymandering, Well, you know, Citizens Not Politicians says, we're trying to get rid of gerrymandering. That's why we're bringing this forward, because we don't want gerrymandered districts. So it ends up in front of the courts, and they're going to have to the justices are going to have to decide, does this language fairly, the summary language that was adopted by the ballot board, does it fairly and accurately represent the amendment itself? And so we should be seeing an argument on that soon. We don't have a date yet, but we should be hearing from the court as to whether this can go forward or whether the ballot board has to go back and adopt different language.
And now people representing the two Democratic members of the ballot board are weighing in on this. What are they saying?
Well, the ballot board language had to be filed since Citizens Not Politicians had filed this lawsuit. The state has to come back with an answer. And Secretary of State LaRose and Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost, both Republicans, came up with an answer. And the Democrats on the ballot board, who agreed largely with Citizens Not Politicians in this whole thing, they were not consulted. They say they were not consulted to put any input into the answer. Their point of view was never given, and that the answer that was sent back only reflects the opinion of the majority of the ballot board. And they're saying they should have been allowed to give their point of view in that. They also wanted to hire outside counsel to represent them in this case. They say that there's been other times in different cases where that's been allowed, and they are not being allowed to have that. So, or at least have the state pay for that. So anyway, it's a fight over the answer to this. And Secretary of State LaRose says, you know, he was speaking for the entire board when he and Attorney General Yost filed the answer, and that the minority opinion of the board does not need to be in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Secretary of State LaRose is saying, hey, we've got to respond as the majority voted. That, right. Like, that's what we did. And Attorney General, yep, Dave Yost, how does he address this question of outside counsel? Is that something you said the Democrats are saying, hey, sometimes that happens? What's he saying about that?
Well, he's saying that they are not entitled to outside counsel because he said outside counsel is not meant to represent individual opinions. So, you know, we're talking two members of a 5-member board that have the same opinion. They cannot get their counsel paid for. Now, they will have counsel, let's be clear. It's just that they'll have to pay for it.
Mm. Well, Joe, let's follow up on another court case we talked about during last week's Friday News Review. We talked about this case before, a Franklin County judge that was challenging an Ohio law that requires a 24-hour waiting period for abortions. The judge issued a ruling on that last Friday. Tell us what the judge ruled.
Well, the judge ruled that the state cannot enforce this 24-hour waiting period. Now, during this 24-hour waiting period, what happens is a woman goes in for an abortion, and when they go in, they're given information about the gestational age of the pregnancy and the likelihood of carrying it to term, and they are told you have to wait 24 hours before you can come back and complete the procedure. So it's a true two-trip visit under the law that we've had in Ohio. It's been in place for more than a decade. So what happened was the court came back and said, we are going to issue an injunction so that law cannot be enforced anymore. And then this is going to continue to be argued in court. That happened, as you said, Friday. And at the first of this week, a lot of the state's abortion clinics have said they're not doing the 24-hour waiting period anymore. The reason that this has been put on hold, though, is you remember back in November, voters approved a constitutional amendment that guaranteed reproductive rights. And that amendment is what the court said makes the 24-hour waiting period illegal.
How have the state's abortion opponents responded to this change?
Well, they're obviously upset with it. They say that the 24-hour waiting period there were real reasons for it, that one of the things that Mike Ganadakis, president of Ohio Right to Life, told me was that women who are in trafficking situations, women who are confused with, you know, some sort of problem, domestic violence, something like that, they might, you know, come in, and that 24-hour waiting period might be enough to keep them from getting an abortion. Now, there are studies, I might mention, there are numerous studies that show that waiting periods like our 24-hour waiting period do not have that effect. But at any rate, the opponents of abortion like that 24-hour waiting period because they said it gave a woman, you know, a chance to think, clear their head, and maybe they wouldn't have gone through with it.
And the providers, I understand it, are saying, hey, that 24-hour waiting period is just a barrier that, that women shouldn't have to deal with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because they're saying, you know, women come in, and you got to remember there are women coming from other states now because states around us have outlawed abortion. So women come in and they want an abortion. It requires them to stay overnight in a hotel. They might not have that kind of money to do that. It requires them to travel a long distance already to get there. And so if they don't stay all night, they have to travel back, and that can be costly. It requires 2 days of childcare if they're finding someone to take care of their kids. Just, you know, they say it is it's setting up barriers to getting an abortion, which the amendment that was approved says you can't do.
Well, Sarah, I want to talk to you now about some potential action that Ohio lawmakers could be looking at in their next legislative session, and that has to deal with local tax laws. An interest in local tax laws, that's kind of different from what the state lawmakers' focus has been, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think this legislative session, you've seen a lot of different ideas and a lot of different bills proposed. Nothing's really made serious moves, but regarding things like abolishing state income tax, you know, taking different action on property taxes, which are, you know, obviously technically local taxes, but the Ohio Chamber of Commerce released a study regarding tax burdens in Ohio, and something that the study really highlighted was that the chamber feels that Ohio's local municipal tax burden is really high. The chamber is a really powerful group on Capitol Square. They represent, you know, business interests for businesses all around the state. And they say that, you know, these municipal taxes put a lot of burden on businesses that might be operating in multiple counties. So they have, you know, employees in multiple business jurisdictions. So the state really hasn't done anything significant with local tax legislation in about a decade. So it'd be really interesting if this comes to fruition next session, but it definitely has the ear of the Chamber of Commerce.
What are some of the potential changes? I mean, is this an effort to get rid of municipal income taxes?
Senior lobbyist Rick Carfagna tells me no. He's with the Chamber of Commerce. He says they don't want to get rid of municipal tax, is they don't even want to retool the rates at all. But I think there's a fear on the other side. I talked with Kent Skerritt with the Ohio Municipal League. He says that oftentimes, even if lawmakers say they're not going to do anything with the rates or anything like that, it still ends up affecting municipal taxes.
So it sounds like he's concerned about what this could mean for cities if the lawmakers decide to take this on.
Absolutely. He said any changes that they've seen in the past, particularly this big omnibus bill 10 years ago, House Bill 5, he said that the changes that were made were just not revenue neutral, and that he feels like municipalities were hurt. But like I said, the Chamber of Commerce says they don't want to do away with municipal taxes in any way. The big focus on their part and the thing that they'd like to see lawmakers pick up is finding ways to make it easier to maybe file those taxes, because some of it is not just the taxes themselves and that the Chamber of Commerce finds those burdensome. It's also the process to actually file those taxes, because of course you have systems like RITA, where a bunch of municipalities are using the same system, but some municipalities collect the taxes on their own. So it's a very different by jurisdiction system.
Okay. Well, I know you will be keeping an eye on that for us. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles and Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, we'll hear about an Enquirer investigation into injuries and deaths caused by Metro buses. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Just this week, a former Metro bus driver was in court to be sentenced for hitting and killing a retired schoolteacher earlier this year. A Cincinnati Enquirer investigation found that's not the only serious problem Metro has had with driver performance. Joining me now to discuss her findings is Cincinnati Enquirer Enterprise and Watchdog reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry. Welcome back, Patty.
Hi, Lucy.
Thanks for being here. Patty, explain the numbers to us. How many people have been injured or killed by Metro buses over the past 10 years?
The federal data shows there have been 275 accidents involving Metro buses. Now, that includes all kinds of accidents. It might be or incidents. It might be the bus driver being assaulted by passengers, which happens from time to time. It might be passengers on the bus who tumble, you know, at a fast stop, et cetera. But a number of these are folks who are injured by a bus, either as pedestrians or when they're motorists.
Mm-hmm. So 275, and not all of those are collisions between a bus driver and a pedestrian or another motorist, certainly. Do you have any feel for, is there a way to put that into context, kind of out looking at that number compared to the overall miles that are driven or routes, or I don't know how to kind of gauge how big a number that is?
Right. It is hard to understand pulling these numbers from a federal database. I don't have a good basis of comparison, but Metro buses drove 13 million miles last year. So all things considered, 275 might sound like a large number, but it's over a decade. And as I said, there are many different explanations for these various reports. We honed in on the most serious of these. We looked at 14 pedestrian deaths, or excuse me, not deaths, pedestrian accidents, pedestrians who were hit by a Metro bus during that time, as well as the four deaths over the past decade.
What's going on with Metro drivers? Is there a staffing problem there?
It is difficult for Metro to find drivers. They talk about that frequently. They recruit constantly. They're always having job fairs. They offer signing bonuses to get people interested. You know, they reach out in multiple ways. But there's also turnover. Metro drivers come into the system and leave the system. At present, Metro says it's 14% of those hired in a given year leave in a given year. That's the 2024
Wow.
number. But we found by looking at overall a decade's worth of what I defined as churn, that it was 80% of 600 and some drivers hired over a decade, more than 500 left. Now, Metro explains, and I did include this in the story, that 500 were not all hired in that same period. They could have been there for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, could have left for any number of reasons, right? Just retirement, you know, all kinds of reasons why somebody leaves. But nonetheless, that's a large number of drivers going out the door over a 10-year period, and the present rate, as I said, is ranging between 14 and 16 recently, hired and left in the same year.
Sure, because anytime you have somebody leave a position, that's somebody who's trained and knows how to do the job. Somebody different has to be trained. How are drivers trained at Metro? Is it a very intensive process?
It's an 8 to 10 week process where there's a trainer on board that rides with them. So they are, you know, supervised closely through that period. But after the 8 to 10 weeks, they are on their own on the route. However, when there are any incidents, you know, they are monitored very closely. They are reported to Metro, and there's corrective action taken, for accidents.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's a difficult job driving a huge bus filled with passengers, so many distractions coming from all different angles. Were you able to talk with any drivers about this or union representatives? What did they have to say about this?
I did talk with Frank Harper, the president of the union, and he did acknowledge, you know, this is a hard job. It's a challenging job. You've got a 40-foot, 14-ton piece of equipment. And you do have to pay attention to so many different things on the road, just as you and I as motorists need to. But there's more at stake if you're driving a bus, right? Mm-hmm. You've got people's lives at stake. You've got pedestrians and motorists that you have to keep safe as well. So I didn't really go the route of trying to talk to a lot of drivers. This is really a story that was based more on public records from the federal government and, very importantly, from Metro itself. Mm-hmm. We made a large number of requests for public records. Metro complied. I got back everything I wanted except one that I'm still waiting on. And so the various metrics of driver performance are based on their own internal records.
How did Metro's CEO respond to your findings when you talked with him about everything that this information showed?
Right. I tried to be very transparent with Metro. I shared my overall findings before I even went to the interview. I collated them all and said, this is what I'm seeing in your numbers, and I'd like you to respond. Daryl Haley did grant me an interview, but the first thing he wanted to talk about was Metro's growth story. And it is a growing bus system, right? Ridership is up slightly this year. After, you know, tanking during COVID, it came back. It came back strong. And Metro has been under this multi-year expansion because of a 2020 tax levy that voters put in place. And so, yes, it's a growing bus system. They're expanding. They've got a bunch of different initiatives underway. He wanted to talk about all of that, even knowing that that was not the focus of my story. And he did address, you know, the focus on safety. You know, talked about their training program, talked about it being, you know, the highest priority to keep people safe. But that was really the extent of it.
Yeah. Are the metrics that Metro uses internally to judge driver performance, are those getting better?
Well, the turnover, you know, looks dramatic when you look at that 5-year measurement. But, you know, now at that 14% is about where it typically has been. The missed trips metric is getting better. So the things that I looked at specifically, turnover, missed trips, late trips, early trips, because you get to the bus stop late or early, the passenger can't get the route that they want, absenteeism, preventable accidents, overall violations of Metro policy, last chance agreements, lawsuits filed against Metro, and points on driver's licenses. And all of those, to at least the layman, the civilian, appear to be flags, right? Like, these are things that sound to the untrained ear like these are things worth delving into and exploring. And so that's what we tried to do in our story, is look at all of these things kind of collectively. And then, of course, we talked to some folks who were harmed directly by buses.
Mm-hmm. And with all those different things that you looked at, did you find that the numbers seemed to be trending in a more positive direction or trending in a more negative direction? Or were you able to suss that out?
In a more positive direction. Mm-hmm. So Metro is keenly aware of all these metrics. It shares them with its board every meeting. It has a slide deck that shows these. It's just that we at the Enquirer had never delved into these metrics before, mm-hmm. and put them in front of readers.
Yeah.
So yes, they do say that they're on the upswing and that many of these measures of driver performance are improving.
You mentioned points on Metro driver's licenses. How many points can a Metro driver have on his or her license and still keep the job?
Metro will not hire someone who has 4 points on their license. And an Ohio license, 12 in a given year, it equates to violations. Not every violation is 1 point. Some violations are 2 points. You lose your license if you get 12 points in a given year. Metro will not hire you if you have 4 points. And it will dismiss you if you get up to 7 points. So if you hit 6, And you're going to be watched carefully. And we did find that out of 530 drivers, there's a handful that do have either 4 points or 6 points.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meaning that they wouldn't be eligible to be hired today if they were applying for their job.
Mm-hmm. It's an important distinction. You talked with people injured by Metro buses. Tell us about a couple of them and just the lasting impact that these injuries have had.
I talked to two women who were hit by Metro buses, both left with severe and lasting leg and foot injuries. Sally Gaynor was hit in 2017 right off of Fountain Square. Her leg was degloved, a word I had never heard before, but it essentially wipes all the skin off your entire right, I think it was right leg in her case, from her hip to her ankle. She had a long recovery process. She was in the hospital for more than a month. She was off work for 6 months. And the lasting effect for her is mental. Fear of sirens. She and her husband actually left Cincinnati and moved to a home they had in Indiana just to get out of downtown. They lived downtown at the time. Emily Frank was hurt in 2016. This is a case that got a lot of attention back when it happened. She was walking in Hyde Park Square with her father after they'd had dinner. The bus hit them both. Frank, her father, was killed at the scene. Stephen Frank, his last name was Frank. Stephen Frank was killed at the scene, and Emily Frank was left with a severe foot injury. That's really impacted her life ever since. It's changed her business model. It's changed her daily habits. She is fearful behind the wheel as well. And, you know, the mental turmoil continues. I also briefly talked with the sister of Don Williams, who was killed in June when he was trying to board a bus. And of course, the family of Beverly Kinney, who you just referenced at the top, who was killed in January by a bus driver. Hmm.
There have been court cases over these incidents. We're going to talk a little bit more about the one that you covered this week. And there have been wrongful death lawsuits. And I have to imagine no amount of money can make up for the loss of a loved one like this. But what have these cases cost Metro in recent years? You looked at that, too.
I did. And that is the one document, Lucy, that I didn't get back. Mm. I asked for 10 years worth of settlements to try to have some sense of scale. So what I put in the story is that Metro has paid out more than $18 million over this time period, this 10-year time period. Two of those awards went to the Frank family, Stephen Frank and Emily Frank. $10 million to the estate of Stephen Frank, $1.9 million to the estate of, or to Emily Frank. And then there was another award given to a young man named DiCarlo. Sorry, I'm not remembering his first name. His last name was DiCarlo, who was hit by a Metro bus, the same driver who hit and killed Beverly Kinney. And he was left in a wheelchair with a feeding tube. And there was a settlement to his family. I did reach out to that family, and they chose not to speak.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be very painful to be talking about these things. I mentioned this court hearing just this week involving the death of Beverly Kinney. She was a beloved longtime volunteer here at Cincinnati Public Radio. What happened at that hearing?
Yeah, that was just yesterday. This was a sentencing hearing for Dion Willis, who was the bus driver who hit and killed Beverly Kinney. He had pled guilty to one charge, one misdemeanor charge of vehicular manslaughter. The city of Cincinnati wanted him to get the maximum available sentence, but the judge in the case went with probation instead of jail time. So he was eligible for up to 6 months and a $1,000 fine and a 5-year suspension of his license. The judge sentenced him instead to 5 years probation, 5 years with a suspended license, and 1,000 hours of community service. So the family of Beverly Kinney was quite disappointed that he's not going to serve any jail time. And that's where it ended as of yesterday. They're moving forward with a civil case, seeking a wrongful death suit that will be in court next month.
Hmm. You mentioned that such an important part of this reporting was public records. talk a little bit about the records you used for this investigation. You said there were federal, but also records for Metro.
Right, two different things. The Federal Department of Transportation maintains safety and incidents that were available. Actually, the Kinney family lawyer is the one who, you know, directed me to those. But Metro itself keeps a lot of different running charts that show driver performance. And here I have to give a tip of the hat to a tipster who was in touch with us early on after the death of Beverly Kinney, and a former employee directed us to certain documents, how to ask for them, what they're called. You know, as you and I know, but not everybody knows, when you ask for a document from a public entity, you need to know what it's called. And you need to be pretty precise and ask in a limited way so that you get what you're looking for. And always have to keep in mind that an entity will not create a record for you, but are compelled under law to provide it if it does exist. So, you know, the things that I mentioned earlier, things like the turnover numbers, missed trips numbers, it's called on-time performance, early or late to a stop. These are all, you know, these are all records that Metro keeps. And again, as I said before, puts in front of its board of directors every month.
Yeah. You mentioned a tipster, and I think for people who aren't in the world of journalism like we are, they may not distinguish that from an anonymous source. Can you talk about the difference there?
Sure. An anonymous source is somebody who provides information, may be willing to be quoted, may not, but not by name. And we use those in a very limited capacity at the Enquirer. They have to be vetted all the way up to the top editor. There are certain circumstances under which we'll consider. But a tipster is simply somebody who has some specific knowledge, who's in touch and says, I don't want to be interviewed. I don't want to be quoted. I just want to point you to information that might be helpful as you start something. So people who have that willingness to come forward are really valuable to journalists. I had never delved into Metro aside from some very minor stories. And so I was not aware of the extent of the record keeping about drivers that was available.
You mentioned that a lot of these metrics that you were looking at, these measures, that the numbers seem to be trending in a positive direction for Metro. Has Metro said anything different will be happening there as a result of these injuries or deaths?
They did not. Daryl Haley responded with a letter to the editor, which we published. He pointed to Metro's safety records, saying that it ranks number one for among its peers. It's a very among its peers for the category of time between accidents, which I assume is an important measure in his world. But nonetheless, you know, the facts are the facts, the numbers are the numbers. And also wanted to provide context about some of the incidents that we reported, that certain persons were cleared of wrongdoing by police in addition to Metro, that kind of thing. So, but beyond that, no, they have not announced or responded in any way like we're going to really, you know, redouble our efforts in this category. We're going to change up our training in this way. I did sit in on the Metro, the board of Metro, which is
sorta,
right. I sat in that meeting this week. There was no mention of this coverage, at least in the public part of the meeting. So if Metro is planning anything, I'm unaware of it.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer, Enterprise, and Watchdog reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry. Thanks so much for your time today, Patty.
You bet, Lucy.
Up next, we'll look back at Beatlemania in Cincinnati in 1964 and hear about the disc jockeys that brought the Fab Four to town. This is Cincinnati Edition.
Oh, yeah, tell you something. I think you understand.
The year was 1964, and Beatlemania was sweeping the nation. Fortunately for Cincinnati fans, some local disc jockeys got ahead of the curve. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to look back at how the Fab Four ended up in Cincinnati is WVXU Media Beat writer John Keyswetter. Welcome back, John.
Thank you.
so fun to have you here. I love this story because it seems like something that couldn't happen today. Tell us why these five DJs decided they wanted to get the Beatles to Cincinnati.
I've been a journalist in Cincinnati nearly 50 years. This is one of my all-time favorite stories. So the Beatles broke big in January of 64, and Dusty Rhodes, who was the night guy on WSAI, decided to start this Beatle Booster fan club. And by the time the Beatles played Ed Sullivan in February, he had more than 1,000 members. I mean, it just exploded, and these guys had tapped into something. So after the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, somebody had in another market had said, hey, you ought to just make a pitch, see if the Beatles would come. So the five disc jockeys put up $25,000 and called somebody somewhere, I don't know if it was London or New York, and said, you know, they wanted to bring the Beatles to Cincinnati as part of their North American tour. And on April 10th, they got a telegram saying, yeah, you got them. You got to put down half the money, $12,500, and you can have the Beatles come to Cincinnati Gardens. And Dusty Rhodes is 24. He said he went to the Central Trust branch in Price Hill and got a $5,000 loan, and his in-laws had to co-sign for it.
It's an argument for marrying early, I guess. So $25,000, $12,500 down payment, that doesn't sound like a lot of money for a big act like the Beatles, but I'm betting it was a pretty significant sum back then. I mean, Dusty had to take out a loan.
I would guess. Somebody in national medias would say, okay, and in today's dollars, it was whatever. But I mean, the top ticket price was $550. It was just a totally different time.
Yeah, no kidding. Where did you mention they had the concert? I think at Cincinnati Gardens. Tickets were $550. How did they pull it off? Did Dusty Rhodes or any of these other DJs, did they know anything about producing a concert?
They knew nothing. But one of the five, Paul Purton, was in the National Guard with Dino Santangelo of the Santangelo family that promoted local concerts, including the Ohio Valley Jazz Festival. So they hooked up with him, and they got the gardens, and they quickly sold out 14,000 tickets. Dusty told me that they returned a whole lot, that they probably could have booked five shows, that they had that many tickets, requests that they had to send back. And that a woman I worked with at the Enquirer told me that, who's a little bit older than me, said, you know, we went out, we got our hair done, we got a nice look, and they went to the gardens. Well, the gardens didn't have air conditioning. It never had air conditioning because to put in air conditioning, they had to make it ADD compliant. And there was never elevators put in, and the Robinson family never put in air conditioning. So it was just this big sweat box. And on top of that, most of the fans were standing on their chairs screaming, and you really couldn't hear them play, but they saw the Beatles.
Wow. Well, it sounds like a heck of a night. So all these tickets, all this excitement, the concert happened when Beatlemania was just exploding. Your story included kind of what the scene at the airport was like when the group arrived. Talk about that.
Well, the kids weren't sure where they were coming into. So some kids went to CVG over in Northern Kentucky. Some, Dusty told me, staked out the Anderson Ferry in case they were coming across with a ferry. And more than 1,000 people showed up at Lunkin Airport. And there was just this huge crowd to see them come off the airplane and get in a couple limos. The WSAI good guys, which is what they called the DJs, were there. And a photographer, a local photographer by the name of Walter Burton, took pictures because those who went to the show could have bought or reserved a copy of the Beatles in Cincinnati, this 8x10 booklet with these great photos in it that Walt Burton shot all these. And he rode with them in the limo. And there's some other candids, like when they stopped at a stoplight on Columbia Parkway coming in, and Ringo rolled down the window. This girl about fainted because there's Ringo. So there's, like I said, they got to the gardens, and they did a press conference before. I can't imagine that a major band on the tour today would agree to do a press conference before they went and played. So they did a press conference, and Dusty said they were very nice and polite, and All three TV stations at time, 9, 12, and 5 showed up. And George Palmer from Channel 12 asked that, well, what are you going to do after the concert? And John Lennon said, count the money.
Very different times. That's a lot of honesty right there.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, now I should mention, you talked about how there was no air conditioning at the gardens. There was a big anniversary of this concert, right? Was this because this happened in August of 64, is that correct?
Right. 10 years ago when I was at the Enquirer, I did a big 50th anniversary package. In fact, through social media, tracked down probably 10, 12 different people who had been there. There were 7 contest winners at WSAI to meet the Beatles right after the press conference. And we had a photo of one woman, teenage woman, meeting the Beatles, and I tracked her down and got comments from her. And it was such an iconic moment. Everybody remembers the Beatles coming to Cincinnati. Then they came 2 years later and played Crosley Field. But having the Beatles here in August of 64, it was just a couple of weeks after the release of Hard Day's Night. And here's the other thing about it. They were only on stage, I've heard two accounts, 28 or 30 minutes. They did 12 songs. They flew into town, did 12 songs, went back to London, got an airport, went back to New York City.
So what was it like talking to Dusty Rhodes about this? This has got to be a really fun highlight for him to reminisce about.
Over the years, I've talked to him about it many times. In my story that's at WVXU, in my blog at WVXU.org, I actually have a copy of the telegram that they received on April 10th. And I've talked to him numerous times. But when I called him last week, I said, you know, can you believe this? It says, 60 years later, you're still talking about the Beatle. He said, never in a million years would I imagine that. But he said it was an outstanding night. It was an amazing night and one of the highlights of his career.
Yeah. Well, I would encourage everyone to check out your story on WVXU.org because you have some information about a photo exhibit that's happening right now that has some of those wonderful concert photos.
Right, up in Morrow at a little cafe called Fresh Tomorrow. They're Walter Burton's photographs that I mentioned.
That's great. Well, I've been talking with WVXU media beat writer John Kieswetter. Thanks so much for your time today, John. I hope you have a rockin' weekend.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. You know you love like that, you know you should be glad.